This week, we go back to New Year's Eve in the year 2000 with a fascinatingly, eerily prescient report by Linda Moulton Howe on what's to come in 2001 that it really is meaningful for today. Then, William Henry, on his book Blue Apples, which is still available, I believe, in the unknowncountry.com store. Fascinating material. We were just in the process of discovering William Henry back in those days, so it's very, very illuminating, a wonderful show to listen to. And remember, of course, that none of the 800 numbers mentioned are active. None of the ads are active. This is a show from the year 2000, and welcome to it. It's lots of fun.
Winging your way across the stormy Atlantic. Happy New Year. It just became 2001 in mid-Atlantic time. Just beyond the edge of the new millennium lies an unknown country, a realm of mirrors and truths and the unexpected. If you dare not travel in this country, then we urge you, stay in the year 2000. You got to get in a plane, and you got to travel west at 1,000 miles an hour, but you can stay ahead of the future for a little while. But if you hunger for high adventure and life at the extreme edge, then welcome to 2001, the real beginning of the new millennium. This is Whitley Strieber, and tonight on Dreamland we have William Henry. William Henry describes himself as an investigative mythologist. His appearances on Dreamland have been thrilling as he retells the story of the past in a credible, intelligent, and enlightening way. But first, Linda Moulton Howe talks to us about Trends 2001, an incredible interview with Gerald Celente. It's going to be an extraordinary night on Dreamland as we follow the new year deep into the dark heart of our beloved United States. This is Whitley Strieber, and in just a moment, we'll be back. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland, and we're back. One reporter who loves mysteries is radio's leading science journalist, Linda Moulton Howe. She's an Emmy Award-winning TV producer, documentary filmmaker, and writer who investigates new and unusual aspects of science, medicine, and the environment. Tonight, she has a special report for us on Trends 2001. Here she is from Philadelphia, Linda Moulton Howe.
Hi, Whitley, and happy New Year's Eve. As 2000 comes to an end and the true first year of the 21st century begins, the Trends Research Institute in Rhinebeck, New York, has released its list of top trends in 2001. They include ugly Americans, recession-proofing, peace talks on the drug war, immigration issues, closed minds, involuntary simplicity, reunionizing of the Soviet Union, and corporate dumb-sizing round two. With me to discuss some of these projected trends for the new year is Gerald Celente, director of the Trends Research Institute, publisher of the Trends Journal newsletter, and author of the national bestseller, Trends 2000, Gerald Celente.
We think we are going to be ugly Americans for the foreseeable future because, number one, most Americans are myopic in their view of the outside world, and they're oblivious to the criticisms. I mean, they're certainly not going to find these criticisms on the nightly news, which most people tune into. Secondly, you know, there's this America right or wrong attitude. And the reason countries tolerated the ugly American before was that they needed our military might to protect them. You know, this isn't the end or beginning of World War II, where countries, you know, needed our economic strength and military might. So now that, you know, like in any relationship, when you don't need that person, you become more critical of their faults. So those are some of the reasons why it's not being overlooked, and also the reasons why Americans don't see what's happening to them overseas. They're blinded by an ideology that America, right or wrong, is supreme around the world.
But instead we are resented.
Instead we are becoming more and more resented. Let's take what's going on in China, for instance. You know, Starbucks just opened up in the ancient city in Beijing, and they were also closed down pretty quickly as well. And any time that there's an attack against American interest, you know, they attack the American symbols, whether it's McDonald's in France or, again, Starbucks in China. So you're going to see more and more of anti-Americanism being taken out on the symbols that sell those American products and American ideals. Having said that, there's still going to be a strong demand for a lot of things American. But the demand is going to wane unless Americans understand what's going on abroad.
Are Americans naive to assume that China is going to be the next big economic frontier?
Oh, Linda, what a great question. Yeah, they're very naive. Here's the example that I use. Remember Indonesia, that wonderful place when Suharto, the dictator, you know, that killed about 300,000 people during his reign, and how American corporations and American government tolerated his abuses because, after all, Suharto is building a strong middle class in Indonesia. We heard that great lie for decades. There was no middle class in Indonesia, a country of 150-plus million people. There were the rich that were very small in numbers, and the very large proportion of the country poor. And when we saw the Asian currency crisis hit in 1997, we saw that the Emperor Suharto had no clothes, and there was no middle class in Indonesia. The same thing is true for China. All China is a country with about a billion and a half people whose labor the many countries are exploiting. There's not going to be a huge middle class in China for those great consumer products that so many countries want to sell.
And in terms of one of your concepts in the top trends for 2001, you used the phrase recession proofing. What does an individual or company do to try to make themselves more recession-proof?
For the consumer, it really means a couple of basic things. That your greatest investment is paying off your expensive loans, because there's no way you can take money and put it in, I shouldn't say no way, but highly unlikely, that you'll be able to make an investment that's going to bring in a greater return than the high interest rates that you're paying off on your loans, whether they're mortgages or credit card debt. So we really advise people not to go into any debt. Try to pay off what you have, and for businesses to understand that now is the time not to go bargain hunting, but really to go into new areas of growth opportunities by understanding that the businesses that you're in, the competitive pressures are so great that you may have to look in new directions for new opportunities.
All right, now let's move on to the third on your top trends for 2001, peace talks on drug war.
The drug war, by anyone's calculation, and again, and I say anyone's calculation, if you don't take a side and you search for the truth, you can see that the costs of this war, both in financial terms and socially, have been enormous, and that there's no end in sight to show victory on the horizon. We're noticing that it's becoming more and more apparent in the press and among politicians of all stripes that fighting the drug war is a losing battle. So we are estimating and contemplating and forecasting, actually, that we're going to see peace talks start to take place in the recognition that, yes, it was a noble cause to fight this drug war, but there's no winning it. So the resources of the war are going to be shifted toward not treating the drug war as a crime, but really helping the victims.
Well, how more difficult do you think that this war on drugs will be if, in fact, immigration, which is fourth on your list, begins to try to increase as world economies have problems?
In these best of times, according to the World Bank, hardly, you know, a socialist or left-wing organization, according to them, half the world's working population in these best of times are earning only $2 a day. So you're going to see billions of people searching around the world to find a decent wage, and it means going into the developed countries. So immigration is going to be a huge issue.
Well, now, Closed Minds 2001 on your list, what does that mean?
Well, it means that, you know, people aren't really discussing issues to find the truth, whatever the truth might be, in an issue. And there are universal truths. Instead, people are looking toward supporting their agendas or building their platforms and twisting the language to meet their needs. And we've never seen it more apparent than it is right now. And as a matter of fact, there's this whole dumbing down of thought where, you know, you have the presidential candidates, you know, and important issues, whether they're social, political, or economic, are being discussed on entertainment platforms, you know, from Rosie O'Donnell to David Letterman. You know, hey, which of the presidential candidates do you like best? Do you think we're the funniest? So it's really the closed minds is that, you know, for a country and a world that's transitioning out of a period of remarkable stability into uncharted waters, you know, the future is going to have to be looked at more discerningly than it is now.
What about involuntary simplicity on your list?
Well, remember the voluntary simplicity movement that found life after the crash of 1987, the market crash? And it was going pretty strong up until the late 1990s when the stock market started booming and the gross domestic product began to skyrocket. And we saw people buying, you know, their SUVs and trophy homes, and conspicuous big consumption became the thing to do. Well, now we can all see that the best of economic times are over. People are going to be forced to cut back and tone down. So they're going to find new converts for the simplicity movement, but these ones are going to go into it kicking and screaming because there's, you know, the conspicuous consumption and consumerism, that's what drives America. Two-thirds of our gross domestic product is built on consumption. But like a victim suffering a health crisis, that after the crisis they say, you know, I like my new style of life. You know, I've cut way back on the stress levels as well as the food intake, and now I'm exercising more. I really hated the way I was living before. That's why we call it involuntary simplicity. While people will be involuntarily forced to change their lifestyles, they're going to like their new lifestyle a lot better than the old, because what we're going to be seeing are new philosophical thoughts developing as people begin to understand that they have a purpose and meaning in life, and it's not only to consume, but to find the divine purpose within. You start finding that when you start looking at life a bit more simpler than just consumption.
Why do you think that these booming times of the 90s did not help the Soviet Union to come out of its communism era and actually be able to strongly join the free market capitalism, as you have on your list of top trends in 2001, the Soviet Union actually going backwards again?
The reason it didn't work was for this, the same reason why it's as unrealistic to think that there could be one world religion as it is to believe that there could be one world economic system. The United States system of open or free markets can't fit all structures around the world. And the Soviet Union was not ready. You know, I love, you know, how belief systems become so entrenched and then they fade from everybody's memory. Remember this one, shock therapy?
Mm-hmm.
Well, just as shock therapy doesn't work in real life, it doesn't work with economic life. They're going to go back to a new form of communism. Now, here's the danger. The free marketeers in favor of privatization are going to condemn anything that doesn't fit their theo-economic belief system that the rest of the world should be buying into. So they're going to radicalize the movement in the former Soviet Union rather than accept it. So you're going to see the beginning of a new Cold War. And as a matter of fact, after we wrote these trends, it was announced that Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, is bringing back the theme, the old Soviet national anthem. They're changing the words, but the sound remains the same. They're also bringing back the red flag, minus their hammer and sickle. So you can see the movement is already going in that direction.
For the complete Trends 2001 list, visit my website, www.earthfiles.com, in the environment section. And as we go forward into the new century, I welcome your comments and questions to my email address, earthfiles@earthfiles.com. Again, that's earthfiles@earthfiles.com.
Thank you very much, Linda. That's a great report. I'm really looking forward to a lot of those things happening in the near future. Linda Moultonhaugh's new book is Mysterious Lights and Crop Circles. It's available from whitleysworld.com, or you can call 1-800-898-0284 during business hours for this marvelous book, the definitive book about crop circles. Are they real? Do you want to prove that to yourself, or do you want to prove to your friends that this wonderful mystery is worth looking into and learning about? This book has it all, including pages and pages of wonderful color material. It's exciting. It's new. She has put together something that is so thorough, so scientifically credible in the inimitable Linda Moultonhaugh way. You just should not miss her new book. I'm so proud of her for writing it. A few weeks ago, we spent the entire evening together talking about it, and it was a thrilling experience. It's something that everybody who's concerned about this material, who is interested in the real mysteries of the future, should have, because mysterious lights and crop circles are among the greatest of all mysteries. What's so surprising is that the general media still goes on pretending that it's not real. They're living in their own version of dreamland, aren't they? But their dreamland isn't like our dreamland. Our dreamland is a place where you can see the future. In their dreamland, you can only look in one direction, and that is into the past. This is Whitley Strieber with Dreamland 2001. We'll be back. Thank you.
To purchase cassette copies of this program, dial 1-800-917-4278.
It's Dreamland, and we're back on New Year's Eve 2001. That's right. This is a new program. You're not listening to a tape from somewhere sometime earlier in the year. New Year's Eve 2001, looking ahead into the future. Of course, we could look into the future the same way any day, but there's something about this time of year that tells us that this is when it should be. This has been our New Year's for many, many a century. And when I look into the future, for some reason, I'm always happy. And you'd think, well, everything's coming apart around our ears. And sure it is. Well, hasn't that always been the case in human history? Isn't always everything coming apart? But then you look around us at all of the wonder, especially at the wonderful children. What a world of children we have today. I meet children all the time who seem to me like living miracles. You know, there's a section on our website about the Indigo children, which will give you an idea, I think, that you will not forget. If you go in and look at that, at the Indigo children, click through to some of the websites on it, see what kids are doing, what kind of kids are like there. It's really wonderful. Of course, our website, as always, is whitleysworld.com, and we're going to be having some big surprises there this month, incidentally. A lot to look forward to, a whole lot. Now, in a couple of minutes, I'm going to have William Henry with me for the rest of the evening. William Henry is, quite frankly, one of the most learned, and I mean deeply learned, people about the secret history of the past who is around right now. I have rarely met, and I've met them all, anybody who has as much inner knowledge of organizations like the Templars, the Rosicrucians, the Cathars, the secret history of Masonry, the real meaning of ancient Egypt, the secret technology of the gods and the technologies that surround all kinds of lost science from the distant past. And one of the first things I'm going to do is to try to see if I can't get out of him who he really is. Why does this fairly young-looking guy have all of this information? Where did it come from? He'll probably give us a kind of a pat answer, but I have a feeling always when I'm talking to William Henry that I'm talking to some kind of an insider. I don't know what kind of an insider. Maybe tonight we'll find out as we talk to William Henry about the way the secret past foretells the future. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland, and we'll be right back. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We're back with William Henry. William Henry has described himself as an investigative mythologist. We'll find out in just a minute what that means. His mission is to search ancient texts images and architecture for the secrets of spiritual vision that once formed a lost technology of the soul. We're going to talk about all kinds of things, and we're going to revision the past in a completely new way tonight with William Henry, because he's the author, in addition to one of Dreamland's bestsellers, One Foot in Atlantis, of four other books, which are only available in a few places. One of them is over our website or over our 800 number, 1-800-898-0284. And these books three of them are $27.50 each. And the fourth one, which is a book about the occult history of Nashville, Tennessee, is $17.95. You can get the whole group for $95.50. And as we go through this tonight, I think you're going to be amazed at the fact that anybody has ever been able to put together a history of the secret science of the past that's quite like this. Great to have you with us, William.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you, Willie.
William, before you came on the air, I told the listeners that I'm confused about you. I don't know where you come from. I don't know how you got a lot of this information. And we'd like to hear you explain yourself, if you can.
Gosh, that's a tall order. We have this tonight and then a couple more interviews to do this in?
How did you first get into this?
Oh, it's really very, very simple. I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, and I moved down here to Nashville, where I presently live, well, actually outside in Hendersonville, and I was intent on becoming an entertainment lawyer, of all things, and there's a small Southern Baptist college, the kind where chewing gum and bubble gum and dancing are prohibited, where I chose to go to school. And one day when I was in my sociology class, I was a sophomore at the time, sociology professor assigned us to do a book report, just a three-page report on a book that would impact Christianity. Well, at that time, there was a brand new book that was fast becoming an international bestseller called Holy Blood, Holy Grail.
Right, very familiar with it.
Yeah, and if the listeners are familiar with it, this book is a sensational piece of research, high quality research, that proposes that the crucifixion of Jesus was a carefully scripted drama, which Jesus survived and took a secret mystery teaching with him, along with his spouse, Mary Magdalene, and lived in southern France, lived out his days there, and deposited these secrets in the soil there, or in the landscape in southern France, at a place called Rennes-le-Château, which is a place of enormous mystery. I ended up writing a 44-page book review on that book. I was asked by my very Southern Baptist professor what I was doing at this particular Southern Baptist college, and invited that perhaps I should take my study elsewhere, which I did.
I see.
And I started following the path of Benjamin Franklin. I became what Franklin called an autodidact. I'm self-taught. Once you pull on the golden thread of these mysteries, as I did in reading Holy Blood, Holy Grail, I was able to verify that large sections of the heresy that they presented in that book were in fact seemingly true from a medical point of view. There's questions about the crucifixion. There's most certainly a well-documented Gnostic mystery tradition that the church attempted to stamp out in the early 1200s. And the fact is that there are large pieces of the story of what is purported to be the greatest story ever told that are missing. And I took it upon myself to honestly and truthfully look for the answers to some of those questions and fill in the gaping holes that have been left open.
And fill them in you have.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, because you've taken this so much farther than they did, and so much farther than anyone else has, but it's not done in a speculative way. You build this brick by brick by brick. And I thought that what I would like to do is the interesting thing about your books is you can open any one of them to any page, and it's at least in my mind, what happens to me is I read a few sentences, and I'm just sort of sort of stunned and thinking, what is going on here? But since you've talked about Holy Blood, Holy Grail at the beginning, I think we ought to begin by discussing blue apples.
Oh, great. Yeah.
Which is a search for the lost Stargate technology and spiritual teachings of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. And over the course of this conversation, we'll get into why it's called Blue Apples. But let's begin by talking about the parchments.
Ah.
The blue apples, what you call the blue apples parchments.
Yes.
And this is because I'm choosing this because this is like one of the places where you jump off from Holy Blood, Holy Grail, into even deeper material.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the parchments in question were discovered at the turn of the 20th century in the 1890s by a priest, one Berenguer Saunier, who had recently been assigned to the parish, a very tiny parish at Rennes-le-Château, which is a hilltop city, or actually a village, in the Pyrenees of southern France. Berenguer Saunier was a lowly church mouse. His parish was dirt poor. And while embarking upon some repairs on the Church of Mary Magdalene at Rennes-le-Château, he happened upon some sealed parchments, which he then sent over to Carcassonne, a nearby city, to the Catholic authorities, who immediately dispatched him to France to have these parchments looked at. Lo and behold, these parchments, upon further decipherment by the church and by other authorities, are believed to contain what is, in the view of some researchers, including those of Holy Blood, Holy Grail, a treasure map, leading to perhaps billions of dollars of the gold of the Knights Templar, perhaps even a library that once belonged to Jesus, the secret lineage of Jesus. There's an awful lot of speculation that goes on about exactly what these parchments are pointing to. They know for a fact, though, however, that what is ever at the core of these secret parchments suddenly transformed this lowly church mouse into an enormously wealthy man. Not only that, but he had some of the highest royalty in Europe coming to Rennes-le-Château to visit him. He had some of the most noted occult authorities in Parisian society making the journey down to southern France to Rennes-le-Château to spend time with him. And whatever it is, no one is actually sure because he ultimately went to his deathbed with this secret.
You know, what's so interesting about the way they reacted to him is that they don't react to him as if he was someone who found a secret and simply sent it on to somebody else. They react to him as if he was something much more than that. They react to him as if he himself was a master of some sort.
He does appear that way, doesn't he, Willie?
And yes,
especially
he does.
When you look at his story, after he began to accumulate his wealth, he fully restored the Church of Mary Magdalene in a very elaborate and very gaudy way, turning the place over and putting in clues to the secret, or to the solution to the mystery of whatever it was that he found.
What are some of those clues?
Well, for one thing, he shows the 14 stations of the cross. And in one of these stations of the cross, he shows Jesus being taken into or possibly out of the tomb underneath a full moon, which of course was never done.
Right.
And this is a tip-off to the Gnostics that Berenguer Saunier is subscribing to this notion that Jesus was alive when he was taken down from the cross, and he was given medical aid by the Essenes and the Therapeutae, the physicians of the soul, who revived him from that great calamity and the unquestioned torture to which he was given.
And who were the physicians of the soul?
The physicians of the soul were also known as the Therapeutae. They're a group of soul masters that trace their lineage deep into ancient Egypt. And it was this group that is believed to have trained Jesus in their innermost core of secrets concerning the transmutation of the human soul, as well as in alchemy, the transmutation of the periodic table of elements.
The transmutation, of course, of the soul, one of the great alchemical secrets was always that the transmutation of the elements was a mirror for transmutation in the soul.
Right.
And that each alchemical transformation represented another step in the soul's journey to freedom. Let me speculate. What if Jesus did die on the cross and was brought back to life? Could that have happened, or something like it?
Oh, that most certainly could have happened.
It fascinates me, and I'll tell you why it does. Last week, we were talking to John Shelby Spong, the very controversial Episcopal Bishop of Newark. And Bishop Spong made what to me was a very, very telling point. He said that before the crucifixion, after the arrest of Christ, the apostles, the followers, were terrified and went into hiding.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever happened to Paul and the others who witnessed the resurrection was so profoundly moving to them that they went out into the world carrying the message. In other words, it transformed them completely in a way that it's hard to think. It transformed them this much that if you lived right now in communist China, and you suddenly decided, after having lived a life in hiding, to go out and preach the gospel on the street corners, it would be that hard, or harder, to do what they did in the Roman Empire at that time. That's how inspired they were. So there's another thing, and I'm sorry to shift gears here a little bit, but we're kind of getting into another area, and we'll continue with this because we're coming up on the top of the hour, I know. But let's talk a little bit about the concept of the flower, and Jesus as the flower, as the rose, and we'll get into the idea of Adonis and all of that material, because I'm leading up to something here about the resurrection that I think is extremely important and that we can come to together, kind of. So why don't you talk about Nazareth and the flower and Jesus as the rose on the cross?
Right, of course. Well, first, the word rose means wisdom. And so, like, for example, when Moses had his encounter with the burning bush, no one is exactly sure what that bush was, but we do know that wisdom emerged from it. So Moses had an encounter with a bush that yielded some kind of fantastic wisdom. And then, of course, we know that Jesus fulfilled the prophecies of Moses. And in so doing, we would anticipate that he would, too, have an encounter with some form of a burning bush or a flower of wisdom. And that, I believe, is what we're talking about at the crucifixion. There's a Druid scholar by the name of Godfrey Higgins who looked into the original meaning of the word Nazareth, the town of Nazir. And he said that it means the flower, and that this flower was situated in the garden or vineyard, the garden of God, which he called Carmel. And within this garden was where we found the flower, or the flower of life. And in my mythological research, I found that this flower, or flower of wisdom, flower of light, was an actual device. It was a piece of technology, an artifact, that was capable of reaching into the highest heaven and pulling down the highest wisdom, the pure light of heaven, and bringing it temporarily into the earth frame, the earth plane.
But how do you think that this actually worked? What was it like to use it, and what did it look like?
Well, that's how I spend my whole days, is trying to understand this technology, this process. And this is, of course, the subject of the book Blue Apples. I've traced this flower, or flower of wisdom, to Egypt, where we find a 40-foot tall device, a golden pillar-shaped device that, according to Egyptian myth and legend, could be used to drill holes in space. In other words, this device could open what a physicist today would call a stargate or a wormhole. And through this stargate or wormhole, communication was allowed between point A on Earth and point B wherever was designated in the cosmos or within our Milky Way galaxy.
Communication and movement?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Movement also?
Yes.
Well, that is mind-blowing that there's any indication at all that a technology like that ever existed on this planet. We're going to be talking to William Henry a little bit more deeply about the possibility that there is a lost science of Stargate technology out there somewhere waiting for us to discover. This is Whitley Strieber, it's Dreamland, and we'll be back. Say Happy New Year to everybody in East Greenland time, which is also called Rio time. Rio, Buenos Aires, eastern half of Greenland, as the new year, 2001, races towards us for 1,000 miles an hour. It's been the new year in East Greenland time for about 8 minutes at this point. Exciting to count down the new year this way and to feel the change of the millennium coming toward us, because really the beginning of the millennium is the year 2001. The computer millennium was the year 2000, but that was because of the millennium bug. It had nothing to do with the fact that the actual new millennium begins this year, and so much is going on. You know, before the end of another few years, we're going to be in the position, and if you can believe it, they're already patenting this sort of thing, of being able to make hybrid creatures that are part human and part animal. What are we going to do with this when all of God's secrets are in our very young hands? What are we going to do when all of God's secrets are in the hands man? One thing we're doing tonight is we're looking into the deep past to see if this may not be the pinnacle of civilization, but rather that all of our history has been a long journey back up, step by painful step, from darkness and ignorance of a fall from the grace of a great lost civilization, up to where we are now, just about to grasp the golden apple once again and come into the kind of knowledge that may make us able to solve the mysteries of inner and outer space. I've got a feeling that 2001 is going to be a real interesting year. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We'll be right back. Will to fade it back. William, can you tell us a little bit about this music?
the music is comes from a very beautiful soul. Her name is Sarah Beth Heron, and it's part of a CD she's going to have out in the spring of her romantic spiritual music. And she reminds me of so much of Jimmy Webb, the way he was a great songwriter who could pull from just that little dimension over extra that a lot of writers and composers try their best to go to, but some just naturally can do it. Sarah Beth is one of those.
Well, great. Well, we'll certainly be looking forward to listening to that CD and using it from time to time on Dreamland as bumper music.
Isn't it phenomenal?
Oh, it's phenomenal. It's just beautiful. Okay, we were talking about interdimensional gateways and doorways between the worlds. And we're going to keep going around this long kind of circuitous journey and speaking about the flower of wisdom. You know, a very interesting thing about flowers and Jesus, and it relates to the Shroud of Turin, because what has been discovered in the texture of the Shroud of Turin, on the surface, there are, and this has been discovered, I believe, by computer reimaging of the shadows on the surface of the shroud, there are floral images. The body of the man in the shroud was lying in a bed of flowers, and they were flowers from the region, actually, of Ben of Nazareth. And let's talk a little bit about the Garden of the Gods and the flowers.
Yeah, those flowers are remarkable, aren't they?
Yes.
There's a shroud researcher over at Duke University that has pointed out also that there's coins that were placed over the image of the person's eyes on the Shroud of Turin, dating it to that time.
Yes.
And part of my research has revealed that we have to remember that up until the year 600, the word cross did not appear in the Bible. The word that was used was pillar. And in fact, the Greek word to describe the pillar or cross upon which Jesus was crucified was stavro, which literally means pillar of wisdom, which is virtually the same thing as the flower of wisdom, the flower of life that we've been describing here. And my take on the crucifixion is that it was a Stargate event in which the flower of life, this magnificent piece of ancient technology, was present that opened up a gateway linking Earth and ultimately the central point in heaven, a place that the ancients called Tula, and that Jesus made the journey to this place and returned with sacred knowledge about how anyone can perform the identical feat. And along with that came enormous knowledge about the human soul, incredible knowledge about alchemy, incredible knowledge about, in fact, our whole Milky Way galaxy. And these teachings that he had were couched then in the language of flowers, or what's also called the language of the birds, the language of the sacred mysteries. And it always perplexed me that image on the Shroud of Turin, according to Dr. Giles Carter, and Linda Moulton Howe has had very fascinating interviews with him about this, about how that image on the Shroud is actually an X-ray. That what we're looking at when we look at the Shroud of Turin is a piece of undeveloped film. And my question was always, well, if you've got this pillar that stands about 40 feet tall, it's got the Ark of the Covenant, which we know is a communications device as its base, and it's capable of drilling holes in space and of creating X-rays, then how did Jesus interact with this pillar? What happened, and how did those flowers get attached to the Shroud of Turin? And the answer is that I finally came down to was that he was floating in air. He was suspended in midair by this device because it's also an anti-gravity device.
And now, this gets so far out for me that I'm almost in another dimension. And tell us a little bit more about what kind of energy would have been involved and how this worked, but above all, where is it now?
Oh, right. Well, this device we know is capable of creating at least 20 million volts of electricity, at least from the example set by the early Van de Graaff generators that are now at the Boston Museum of Science, which are modeled off of technology that would have been used in conjunction with this Stargate opening device, this pillar of wisdom.
Now, wait a minute. You've just said a whole lot of things that are very fascinating. What exactly is it? Is it the Boston Museum of Technology, did you say?
Yes.
What exactly is there? What are these generators? Where are they from, and who designed them?
They were designed by a MIT physics professor by the name of Van de Graaff. And these devices were used in early atom-smashing experiments. And they're literally particle accelerators, which would have been vital technology in any kind of early Stargate research that would have been presumably present at the crucifixion.
Now, how do they relate to the distant past?
They relate to the distant past because when you go to, for example, the hieroglyph of Osiris, the great risen god of the Egyptian tradition, on
right.
Many believe the Christ story is modeled, when you look at his hieroglyph, he's got models of the Van de Graaff generator and the pillar of wisdom, the flower of life, literally in his hieroglyph. So
okay,
is
that hieroglyph in any of your books?
Yes, it's in almost all of my books.
Yeah, I bet it is. Where is it in, say, Blue Apples?
In Blue Apples, you would probably want to go to in the mid-80s pages. It's near the front of the book.
Right. Near the Pillar of Osiris?
Near the Pillar of Osiris, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now this is fairly amazing, and it's fairly amazing because... And I must confess to having looked at this before, and I was well aware of this, we're talking now, we're not reading a book together. There are two pillars in the hieroglyph of Osiris, which, I have to admit it, they look an awful lot like Van de Graaff generators, which I have seen face to face in the very museum which we were talking about just a moment ago. How do you explain the fact that they would have had such sophisticated equipment so long ago as that?
Well, the notion, as you mentioned during one of the breaks, is that we're looking at Egypt and we're looking at the Essenes, the physicians of the soul, the therapeutae, as inheritors of a great advanced secret science and religion that existed before the time of what is called the biblical flood. And we're talking about an advanced pre-flood civilization that once possessed this sort of technology. The technology was lost after the cataclysm. However, as written about by such people as Graham Hancock and others, there were priesthoods that preserved this technology and passed it along through bloodlines and from generation to generation.
Until a certain man came along and for some reason, perhaps because of who he was, he had the ability and the knowledge to make use of this technology. Is what you say happened?
That's what I say happened. He put the pieces together. Like, for example, when you look at the hieroglyph of Osiris, you see two what are called tet pillars, which are strikingly reminiscent of the Van de Graaff generator.
That's
so much
exactly
so that
what I was referring to a moment ago, yeah.
Right. And in between those is a platform that looks and is a symbol for the Ark of the Covenant. And I think that one of the men that, in addition to Jesus, that had insight into this, at least the person that taught me quite a bit about this technology, was the French prophet Nostradamus. Because he said that there was a missing piece to the Ark of the Covenant. And that once this missing piece, which he described as a pillar, was placed on top of the Ark, a device of enormous power and consequence was created. And so I simply went back to the hieroglyph of Osiris, picked up the pillar that's featured there, and put it on top of the Ark of the Covenant and said, voila, that's the pillar of Osiris. That's what they call the pillar of love, a device that could drill holes in space and open gateways into other dimensions, bringing in a healing and loving vibration that could make the garden grow.
Now, the Pillar of Osiris is an actual, do we not have drawings of this, or have you designed this?
No, this is literally, the hieroglyph I'm showing comes from Egyptian temple inscriptions. We have all kinds of depictions of this device in use and in practice.
What does it look like in use? What are they doing when they're using it?
They're usually toting it around. What they're going to do when they're carrying it around is they're getting ready to set up this device. The Hebrews called it a tele, which literally meant it was a link between earth and heaven. It was a communications device, which is one kind of reason why they would call it a tele, short for like telephone. But it was also a device that was capable of tying the golden thread between earth and heaven. When you see it in the Mayan tradition, and they were very familiar with this technology, they called it a serpent rope. And they said that this serpent rope also joined earth and heaven. And that when earth and heaven were joined, the gods would emerge from within this serpent rope.
Where are the, in the Pillar of Osiris, which I am looking at the drawing of on page 89 of Blue Apples, where is the energy? How does the energy flow work, and what kind of energy is it?
Well, first of all, if the 10 pillars are Van de Graaff generators, they're capable of generating up to 20 million volts of electricity.
Yeah, but 20 million volts of electricity is going to send you to another world, but not quite in the way they've been they were describing.
Right, and so
in other words, I see you might go to heaven. Mm-hmm. But you're not coming back.
Well, and then
not as we understand it.
The answer to that question comes from the Mayans, and again, there is a huge linkage between the Mayan and the Egyptian tradition. So, in my estimation, it's okay to talk about them interchangeably. And according to the Mayans, they said they were going to get the energy from the black hole that exists at the galactic core of our Milky Way galaxy, which is an enormous repository of energy. If you can tap that black hole in the theoretical white hole, the cosmic gusher of energy that's believed to be parked beside it, you're home free. So the answer to where they're getting this energy is from another dimension, from a hyperdimensional realm.
Where did they say this, the Mayan?
This comes from mostly codexes, Mayan books that were turned up and began to be interpreted in the 80s. There's a person by the name of John Major Jenkins that wrote a phenomenal book called Maya Cosmogenesis 2012 that discusses a lot of this imagery and the artwork that's contained that centers on the Mayan belief that coming in 2012, Earth and the Sun will be in direct alignment with the galactic core, and it is then that one of these gateways to the central Sun will be opened.
Incidentally, you are maybe hearing in the background our computer suddenly decided to reconnect itself. Why, I don't know. Perhaps it's being contacted by the black hole at the center of the galaxy. I'm not really sure what's going on in here electronically, but something strange is, that's for certain. Normally it sits there quietly doing its thing, and why this suddenly popped up at this particular moment when we're talking about mysterious energies, I don't really know. Strange. Okay, let's keep going. Let's talk about the place that this ladder leads to, if we can sort of change our imagery a little bit from a pillar now to a ladder, which I think you would probably agree we could do. What precisely was it like? What is it like, and where may it be?
The place that the pillar, the ladder, connected to.
Yeah, the heaven, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
You used another word for it a few minutes ago.
I used the word Tula.
Tula, yeah.
The galactic core, the central sun. And I derived that word Tula, which is a Sanskrit word meaning balance, from the Greeks, who said that the Greeks as well as the Druids came from a central point in heaven. And the name for heaven they used was Hyperborea. But at the center of heaven was a mecca for learning that they called Tula. Various names ascribed to this place include the Pure Place, the White Island, the Place of Herons. Ancient myths and legends say that this is the place where our souls came from.
There's something interesting. We're coming up on the bottom of the hour. That's what that music's all about. So something fascinating that we are listening as William Henry talks. The deeper we go back into the past, the more we find ourselves talking about journeys to and from the stars. And in a few minutes, we will be discussing with William Henry a question. Did we once travel the reaches of space in the distant past? And is the technology available in memory for us to do it again? This is Whitley Strieber at Streamland, and we'll be back.
Get it in writing with the After Dark Newsletter at 888-727-5505.
The last few hours of the year 2000 and the real beginning of the new millennium, which is racing toward us at 1,000 miles an hour. In just a little while, the top of the hour, we will reach New Year's in Atlantic Standard Time. That'll mean we'll be saying Happy New Year to the people of Halifax, the Canadian Maritimes, Santiago, all kinds of different places like that. We'll do all of that later. We've been talking to William Henry, and we're really leading up to a question, the beginning of a question. Is this a fallen civilization? Did mankind once travel to the stars? Is that the secret of the lost past? William Henry says that it's all technologically valid, that there was a lost science. He calls it a science of the soul and describes it as a science that involves the ability to manipulate vast energies over unimaginably great distances, far, far more than even in our wildest dreams we can do in the year 2000. But will we recover the technology of the lost past in the year 2001 or somewhere close? Because between now and the year 2012, 2013, there is a great amount of change coming. No question about it. We're up against a wall environmentally, about to fall off of a cliff. The old Earth can't hang on to us anymore. Mama's womb just can't bear the weight of the child. We are that child. One way or another, we're going to be born. I think it's going to be marvelous. I think it's going to be tremendously exciting. The reason I'm doing this show tonight is I think a big part of it is going to be the discovery of what we lost in the past, and the most important part of that is understanding the secret science of the soul. And when we come back with William Henry in a couple of minutes, we're going to go another step down that road. We've been talking about one of his four privately published books that are available on whitleysworld.com on the William Henry special page. You just go down, look down the right column under the Whitley's World store, and you'll find that there is a William Henry, the left column, there is a William Henry special page. I think this is that important. That's why he has his own page on this store. He and Linda Moulton Howe are the only people who do for a reason. This is important. This is well worked out. This is intelligent. This helps. This is real information. The books are $27.50 each. The one about the occult history of the city of Nashville is $17.95, or I think it's $95.50 for the whole group of them. Well worth having, as I am sure you hear. 1-800-898-0284. During business hours, obviously not tomorrow morning. I think that Denise Twiggs will probably also be enjoying her New Year's Eve. And during business hours, 1-800-898-0284 for William Henry's books, Blue Apples, God Making, The Atomic Christ, The City of Peace, and, of course, his all-time Dreamland bestseller, One Foot in Atlantis, about the occult background and history of World War II. In a couple of seconds, we'll be back with a master of the past and a visionary for the year 2001. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland, and we'll be back. Whitley Strieber, it's Dreamland, and we're back with William Henry. William, we've been talking about the technology of the distant past. Do you believe that we once had access to another level of reality?
Yeah, I truly do believe that we did. And the knowledge of that, the evidence of that, or the hints of that anyway, are encoded in myths and scripture. You find throughout myth and scripture stories of gods traveling on ladders reaching into heaven, of doorways suddenly open, as happened to the Hebrew patriarch Abraham, and the Lord and his messenger stepping through as if out of thin air. The mythological record is just literally loaded with examples of stories like that, of beings that have crossed over the waters, that have walked on water, that have been rescued from water, that all hint at just this notion that there was once an advanced pre-flood civilization that was lost, and all of civilization is a march to reclaim that former level of sophistication, of glory.
What was the flood?
Well, there's several different answers to that question. You have the geological evidence that suggests that there was a cataclysm of some kind in the Middle East. You find people such as Velikovsky that talk about cataclysms caused by interactions with planets in our solar system that shifted the polar ice cap, this sort of thing. But then you also have another more intriguing story that suggests that the original flood took place not on Earth but in the stars. And what the flood was a reference to was a quake, an eruption from the galactic core, a spewing out of an enormous amount of cosmic energy that was called water, that flooded our Milky Way galaxy and flooded our solar system and caused the destruction of past stellar civilizations.
You know, there's no question at all that there was a tremendous catastrophe that befell this planet around 10,000 BC or just around that time. The fossil record is very eloquent about what happened. For one thing, the human population was declining all over the planet. This was the time when we saw the last of the woolly mammoths, which were mysteriously destroyed when the weather changed dramatically in the temperate zones to which they had migrated in the north. What was happening was that, you know, we think of the woolly mammoth as being a creature of ice and snow. It's a very great misconception. This animal had hair, not fur. It was not capable of living in ice and snow. And that's why we find all of these fossils and frozen remains. The creatures froze to death and the weather changed very suddenly. So there was a tremendous disaster of some kind there. But isn't there also evidence of a tremendous heating to the surface of the earth Earth in the Middle East, or am I wrong about that?
I'm not as familiar with that as I am a different kind of heat, and that's the gravitational pull that is exerted when, for example, wandering planets suddenly appear in our solar system, as in the model of Zachariah Sitchin's interpretation of the Sumerian myths that say that, that cataclysms in the past and alterations in Earth's climate were caused by an interaction with a with another planet.
Which is, of course, at the present time, scientifically, it's not one we can find.
Right.
Although we did find a wanderer out beyond the orbit of Pluto, and Zachariah Sitchin made a case that was, of course, ignored by science, that it should be named, I believe, Nibiru, because he said this was the planet that he had predicted would be there, and indeed it is there.
And it's there, that's right.
I wonder if it ever was here, if it passed here in that time. But what's so interesting is, to me, that you have a remarkable thing. You have a species that's capable of reaching the stars.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're knocked so much for a loop that we even forget that we could do that. And it, all of our science turns into myth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that takes a tremendous cataclysm.
It does. It takes a lot of time to recover from something like that as well.
Yes.
And the stories are really pretty alarming when you look back. I mean, to use an example of the Mayans again, they talked about that serpent rope that I described a moment ago, which John Major Jenkins and others suggest is a wormhole, a stargate, through which the gods came down. Well, the purpose of those gods coming down through the black hole wasn't necessarily to educate or to inform or even to have lunch. It was to rescue or save the people from a cataclysm. And so this is one of the reasons for the gods coming down. It, from the very beginning, has been to bring salvation of a different sort. They appear at times of imminent change on the planet when the weather's changing and we're looking at the possibility of cataclysm. And they come down to remove certain elements of the population from the surface of the planet. Others go underground. There's an incredible plethora of stories that talk about civilizations that went into the inner Earth and remained there. So when we look into
are they still there?
And are supposed to be still there, right. And so in the mythological record, you find that cataclysm is something that happens periodically, like clockwork, and part of what we find, at least, for example, in the view of astrophysicist Dr. Paul LaViolette, who discovered high concentrations of cosmic dust in ice age polar ice, he feels that the place that we need to direct most of our attention is where the Mayans are directing us right now, and that's to the galactic core, to the central sun. Because
when you say the Mayans are directing us right now, what do you mean?
Well, when they say that in 2012, Earth and sun will be in alignment with the galactic core, they're talking about an alignment that happens periodically. And in Dr. Violette's view, these cataclysms happen cyclically about every 13,000 to 26,000 years. And as we know, according to the Mayan long count calendar, we're in December 2012 coming to the close of one of these enormous 26,000-year cosmic cycles.
Yes. Do they relate to the zodiac?
Yes, they do, because those 26,000-year cycles, which you might envision as sort of like a cosmic merry-go-round, are divided evenly into 12 new ages of approximately 2,150 years each. And, of course, right now we're presently leaving the age of Pisces, which was introduced by Jesus.
Into the age of Aquarius.
That's right. So we're simultaneously entering a new age while bringing a close to an enormous cycle of time.
Interestingly enough, halfway around this whole procession of the equinox, the whole 26,000-year period, is the time of cataclysm that we've just been discussing.
Mm-hmm.
Just exactly halfway around from now.
Right. And you find symbols such as the Chinese yin-yang symbol, which is a circle split in half with a black dot in the middle of one and a white dot on a black background in the middle of the other. And metaphysically, this represents the interplay, the balance of male and female, negative and positive. But on the cosmic level, it represents that 26,000-year merry-go-round,
right,
where approximately half of it is spent in light and half of it is spent in darkness.
Maria von Detchen and I believe it was Jorge de Santanilla,
mm-hmm,
wrote a wonderful book called Hamlet's Mill,
mm-hmm,
about this cycle.
That's right.
And how profoundly woven into virtually all of the mythological traditions of the world were warnings about this cycle. Now, here's what's to me been always an interesting question. If there is a 13,000-year cycle of upheaval, why is this planet in such good shape? Wouldn't it have been rocked and socked to rubble by now?
Well, our world is alternately destroyed by flood and by fire. And we can think of, just as we can think of flood or water as being a symbol for wisdom, so too can we think of fire as also being a symbol not for literal destruction by flames, as for example in a nuclear detonation, but rather as we can think of fire as frequency, vibration, or even knowledge. And so perhaps when they're talking about our world as being destroyed by fire, one reason we're in pretty decent shape is that what's going to be destroyed is not the literal world, but a mental world, a perspective or a mode of consciousness that will be left behind while we embrace a new consciousness brought about by a new fire, by a new awareness.
That we are actually going to change.
Right.
Because what was the energy that activated the Pillar of Osiris and the Ark of the Covenant? Was it an earth energy, or was it perhaps something from our own mind?
Well, yeah, it's partly
a combination.
It's a combination, because what they talk about is part of the trick is you've got these higher vibrational energies, if you will, emanating from the heart of heaven, which is the mind of God or the heart of God, which is that radiance that was to be captured by the Ark of the Covenant. And what was attempted to do was to catch that energy as it's not only is it descending from heaven, but also on its ascent, its return to the central sun. And so all along, what we're looking for is the place where this energy is going to arise. This used to be done at very specific places on the earth, but the sense that we're getting from various prophecies and from various mystic teachings is that in our time, the entire planet will become one of these places. And
in effect, the whole planet becomes a pillar of Osiris.
That's right. And each of us are the flowers or flowers of this energy, very much like the Pillar of Osiris, that allow this garden of Earth to blossom or bloom.
What happens to the bad guys?
Well, the Hopi talk about that, too. One way to illustrate this, did you ever see the movie Star Trek Generations?
Yes.
Wasn't that a great movie?
It was a beauty.
You had this mad scientist that was chasing this energy ribbon. And once he was, they called this ribbon the Nexus. And when he was in this ribbon, he experienced pure joy, ecstasy, and the manifestation of all his desires. Well, this energy ribbon is somewhat akin to that serpent rope that the Mayans talked about. It's coming to Earth. And when this energy begins to interact with the Earth, more and more our desires will become more and more instantly real. Right now, we have the luxury of a lag time between our thought and our actions. And what the Hopi teach is that during this time, as we enter into this fifth world, as they call it, only love can exist in our hearts because that lag time is going to more and more decrease. So that if we think a thought, it's going to become instantly real. And so what will happen to the bad guys is they won't exist on this realm because according to the Hopi, if only love can exist in our heart, then if we think a thought of fear, we won't be part of the fifth world. We'll be somewhere else.
They don't say where.
They don't say where.
Because there are going to be a lot of people then who end up not joining this?
That is always a very good possibility, and it's, of course, a situation of enormous concern. But the thing that I always take comfort in is that there are lights all over the world that are attempting to show this to us, to teach these teachings, because the ancients talked that there were three levels of souls. You had the gods, then you had the humans in between gods and humans, and then you had just the humans. And the gods were cycling throughout the human race and are giving their teaching in different ways in different civilizations that are most acceptable to those civilizations.
Well, I hear that music again, which means we've come to the top of the hour. And when we come back, you're going to be talking about the hidden meaning of the division of the judgment. This is Whitley Strieber. Welcome to the future. This is Dreamland. We'll be back.
To purchase cassette copies of this program, dial 1-800-917-4278. On the Premier Radio Networks.
We're back. Happy New Year to everybody living in Atlantic Standard Time. That is Canadian Maritimes, Halifax, all the way down to Santiago, Caracas, and La Paz in Bolivia. Well, you might ask, would an American radio program have listeners there? You bet we do. We have listeners all over the world who listen to us on the internet. You would be amazed at where our listeners are, and undoubtedly there is someone in Atlantic Standard Time right now thinking to themselves, well, it's the new year. The new year is racing toward you at 1,000 miles an hour. Want to stay ahead of it? You need a real fast airplane. The fact is, we're not going to stay ahead of it. We are going into the future. And that is what this radio program is all about, because Dreamland has a mission. The mission is to prepare ourselves. It's a very profound and important mission, and we've been talking about it really directly with William Henry tonight. We don't often talk about it so directly, and when we get back with him, we'll be talking more about exactly what we think, what the old wisdom seers are telling us is going to happen, but we think the next 10 or 12 years are actually all about a whole new way of thinking and being that leads up to a complete change of mind. We've been asleep for thousands of years. The sleeping beauty is about to awaken. The baby is about to be born. And what is going to happen on this planet over the next 10 or 12 years is going to be truly extraordinary. Truly extraordinary. And what the most extraordinary thing that's going to happen, though, is a profound evolution of the human mind. And next week on Dreamland, we're going to be talking about the PK Man, a book by Jeffrey Mishlov. The PK Man was a psychic, amazing man. Dead now. It's a sort of a little history, but it's about somebody who was able to do things that in just a few years, any child is going to be able to do. Something is going to happen to us. We are evolving. We are the leading edge of technology. It's inside our heads, the human mind. This is where the greatest changes are going to take place, and exploring what that's going to be like, getting ready for it. This radio program, Dreamland, is a school for the future. This is Whitley Strieber. It's the school for the future, and we'll be back. It's Dreamland. We're back with William Henry, the author of a number of extraordinary, in fact, even incredible books. One Foot in Atlantis, one of Dreamland's best sellers ever, and for good reason. We'll be talking a little bit later about the occult history of modern times. He's also the author of Blue Apples, a magical text about the lost Stargate technology and the spiritual teachings of the past. The Atomic Christ, the search for the secret temple of the Christ light, FDR's search, God-making, how ancient myths of DNA reveal the miracle healing power of our mystic anatomy, City of Peace, the Holy Grail secrets of ancient and modern Nashville. Yes, that's right, Nashville, where he lives. Except for City of Peace, the books are $27.50 each. City of Peace is $17.95. The set is $95.50, well worth getting. And the books aren't fun. They're privately published. You have to get into the world of true esoterica in order to find them. You can find them on our website, and we'll be talking just a minute about William's website as well. You can also get them by calling 1-800-898-0284. And as always, our website is whitleysworld.com. William, can you tell us a little bit about your website?
Yes. The address is www.williamhenry.net. And on it, I have several articles of interest to me and probably interest to those that are listening because they follow along the themes of what we've been discussing tonight. I've got a very interesting one called Christ's Cosmic Wormhole, which is about an incredible story that took place here in my own backyard in Cross Plains, Tennessee, when a figure, a serpent-shaped being, entity, that for all intents and purposes matches the description of the serpent in the Garden of Eden, was attacked by a UFO for over 3 hours, and a family watched the whole episode unfold.
You're kidding.
No, it's a truly phenomenal story.
What eventually occurred?
Well, the family was awakened when they heard a rustling outside, this noise, and the father goes outside and he sees this creature he calls the one-footed snorkel monster that's hopping around on one foot, and it looks like a serpent. And a couple of miles away is a UFO that's parked above what appears to be a radio tower that's firing laser beams at the creature. It appeared to have been hit. The family later remarked that it looked like it had escaped from some sort of an extraterrestrial zoo. In fact, the family dog was struck by the beams coming from this ship as well.
What happened to the dog?
The dog later recovered. He was fine. There was quite a bit of damage that was done to the trees in the yard behind this family's home.
Oh, weird. When did this happen?
1996. Yeah, the weird thing about
it's
it is...
It's the kind of thing you never hear about anywhere else. I must say that right now.
Right.
No one will ever hear about this anywhere else.
No.
Listen up, folks.
It's such an incredible story, and so I started matching up. When I first heard about this story, in fact, my brother-in-law had taken a photo of the creature's footprint, and it had a bird foot, and I was so alarmed by that because when you start researching these wormholes and stargates, you find out that as in the Pillar of Osiris, there is believed to be a literal worm or serpent that lives within this pillar. But it's not, in fact, a serpent. That's a symbol for something else. This is a soul That it,
yes,
that,
the serpent is a symbol for the soul.
Right, and it's the soul that is housed within the particular pillar of Osiris has the ability to drill holes in space. In fact, it's not just a worm or a serpent. It is, we're asked to believe, a wormhole that it itself is capable. That's what this creature can do. Well, when you research this thing, you find out that it's got a bird foot. And in fact, in the Egyptian Edfu text, they talk about the Great Pyramid as being a platform where a sonic weapon was used to shoot at the Great Leaping One in ancient Egypt, which was described in exactly the same terms as this creature has appeared in Cross Plains, Tennessee.
Now, these people, would they have known this?
The family that it happened to?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely not. They were absolutely terrified by what happened.
This is deeply hidden knowledge. I'm sure that maybe nobody listening is aware of this particular mythological being. And having it show up in a backyard near where you live is just fascinating. How did you find out about this?
But purely by accident. I was over at my sister and brother-in-law's house, Kim and Donnie's house, and we were talking as we do for hours about these subjects such as we're talking right now, and I was talking about Shnubis, this mythological creature, and a discovery that I had made on an old alphabet chart about how its bird foot was related to the ancient alphabet, and suddenly the shutters blew up open in Donnie's mind. He said, that sounds like the Snorkel Monster. I said, well, what are you talking about? And he said, well, don't you remember back a few years ago when I got a call from a relative who knew the family that this event happened to? And they couldn't think of anybody else to call but my brother-in-law. And so they called and said, look, you know, we just had this incredible event happen. State troopers have been here, that we've all sworn statements. We've all, in fact, the troopers later told me through another friend that they had missing time on that night, where they were literally off the radio for several hours.
The troopers told you that they personally had missing time. The troopers had missing time.
Yes. And so my brother-in-law goes over there, and he takes a photograph of this creature's footprint. The photograph is up on my website under this article, Christ's Cosmic Wormhole. And that's how the whole thing started. And I remember when my sister and brother-in-law were up, they went around looking for this creature. They felt just an enormous amount of compassion for it, figuring that it had been wounded by this attack from this craft that was floating a couple miles away, and sought from the bottom of their heart to find some way to help it. That they were inspired to in their search because the mother of this family that the event happened to had a daylight sighting of the creature the very next morning. So they knew that it had survived the attack, and were hoping that they might be able to catch a glimpse of it themselves.
Did they ever see it again?
They never saw it again, and there's never been, to my knowledge, another sighting in this area of it. And I speculate about what it might have been doing in Cross Plains, Tennessee. I mean, I think...
Yeah, I mean, it's just so... It's almost laugh-out-loud funny.
It is. It truly is. The one-footed snorkel monster and this kind of thing, matching up with the serpent in the Garden of Eden.
Isn't there also a kind of a sinister side to it that this UFO is firing at it?
Oh, totally.
It's desperately trying to escape from it.
Right.
And what would that have been about?
Because
there's no evidence in the literature of the past that this being is evil or dangerous.
No, there's not. And
in fact, it seems like something that is profoundly empowering to human beings.
Mm-hmm. Which would be one reason why it's given so many alarming epitaphs in literature, just to stay away from the knowledge of this creature.
What do you think that may mean?
Well, I think it's just the profundity of the knowledge that the creature maintains and preserves. Remember, it would have been housed or lived within the Tree of Life, which is in the Garden of Eden story is symbolically equivalent to the Pillar of Osiris, which they called the backbone of Osiris, or in fact the Tree of Life. It was a ladder reaching into the heavens. Well, what I reason I got excited about this story is because at the time I was researching FDR's search for the reincarnated Jesus in Mongolia, and also I came to believe the very pillar of Osiris, which I surmised and talk about in my book Atomic Christ, has nuclear potential. It has the secrets of creating atomic weapons and the transmutation of the elements. And
you suppose they found it?
Pardon me?
You suppose they found it?
I suppose they either, if not the actual device, I feel like they found the blueprints for it or the software for making it work.
The idea, because later they came up with this incredible weapon.
Right. And so what I'm thinking, why, if this is Shanubis, if the snorkel monster is this ancient figure of mythology, and in fact one around which so many scriptures, myths and scriptures are built, was in Cross Plains, Tennessee, was it because it maybe had escaped from a nearby nuclear reactor, say, for example, Oak Ridge, Tennessee, which is just 125 miles down the road?
My word.
I'm wondering, well, okay, let's keep pulling on this thread a little bit. Why did General Leslie Groves choose Oak Ridge, Tennessee to build the world's first nuclear reactor? Does it have anything to do with Cherokee Indian myth and legend that says that Cherokee territory over there, including Oak Ridge, is the location of a hole in space that is connected to a place called Tula? And in fact, the Cherokee call their ancestors not only Pleiadians, but the TLA beings, or the Tula beings.
And this word Tula is all over the world, isn't
it? It's all over the world. And it's, again, a reference to the name of the galactic core, the very center of our Milky Way galaxy, which myths and legends say is permeated by holes in space, or wormholes, stargates, if you will.
You know, I'm almost at the point of not being able to ask you questions. My mind is racing so fast. I'm having more fun right now. This is really fun.
I don't know if I got a chance to before, but I want to thank you once again for allowing me to share this incredibly special evening.
Oh, well, listen, I can tell you right now, the first word, in fact, when I first saw One Foot in Atlantis, I knew immediately that you were onto something. No question in my mind about it. But when we began to talk the last time you were on the radio, I thought that it's more than just being onto something, and that's why I was questioning you about your background earlier, because I think that there's extraordinary and profound knowledge here that you've got, and it's become obvious to me over the course of the program that it's a product of superb research. But I keep asking myself the question again and again, why did you point yourself in these particular directions? And I wonder if you are a soul that is been implanted with instructions from a previous life, or if you know where you're coming from.
I don't have any knowledge of any sort of implantation on that way. I sit amongst
your... It's a wild guess.
I've got just a couple of thousand books that I've accumulated over the past 10, 15 years or so, and I see myself more as I'm someone who loves to plow through them and also loves to point others in the direction of really interesting information. And
yeah.
I think that, like in any field of endeavor, once you reach a critical mass, once you achieve a certain level of understanding, it might appear as if it's all happened all at once, but in fact it's happened over accumulation of many thousands of hours of just pursuing it.
Yeah.
And I think that pursuit acts sort of like a laser beam. If you're on target or anywhere near it, it's going to want to find its target. And I locked on several years ago to this notion of the pillar that connects heaven and earth, and have spent the majority of the past 5 years or so anyway trying to figure out, how does this work and what does it mean to us today? How can we benefit from this knowledge?
Well, if what you say is correct, we found some of this knowledge in the atomic bomb,
yes,
a weapons technology that we were able to use to vanquish evil on this planet in two ways. One was by bringing the end of the Axis to its knees, and the other was with the Cold War, that stalemate that lasted nearly effectively 70 years, but for the most part it was after World War II, that led to the destruction of the Soviet Union. So it has proven to be an immensely powerful, potent, valuable, but incredibly dangerous weapon. And when we get back, we're going to talk about more of the power of the lost science of the past and what it means for the immediate future. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland, and we'll be back.
To subscribe to the After Dark newsletter, dial toll-free 1-888-727-5505. Call now. Continues with Whitley Strieber on the Premier Radio Networks.
We're back. We've been talking to William Henry about the power of an unknown energy from the distant past that may reassert itself in the very near future. And if the ancient calendars are correct, around the year 2012, we would be in alignment core of the galaxy in a certain way that happens only rarely, and this will profoundly change the nature of human experience. Next week, we're going to be talking to Jeffrey Mishlov about the PK Man, the story of a truly amazing psychic of the recent past. He did demonstrably have access to powers that are beyond anything that we can presently understand scientifically. The kind of powers that are so distressing to scientists that they claim that they don't exist, because it rains on their parade. If these powers do exist, then their model of the universe is wrong. Well, it is wrong. It's not complete. It's a very accurate and very useful model in many ways, but it's not complete. And when we talk to Jeffrey Mishlov about the PK Man, you're going to think to yourself, well, this is a very skilled professional researcher, a man with excellent credentials, Jeffrey Mishlov, and he's telling us about something that's totally documented, about a man who could do things that you're just not going to believe, but that are true. That are verified. So how do we swallow that? Well, this radio program is about empowerment. Finding the power within ourselves, half the battle is realizing that it's there. And folks, you listen to Dreamland, you're going to find out it is there. This is Whitley Strieber, it's Dreamland, and we'll be back. Happy New Year's. The new year is racing at 1,000 miles an hour toward in New York City. Less than half an hour left in the year 2000. We thought 2000 would never come. We thought we'd never live through it. But here we are. Isn't that something? I love New Year's. Because, you know, I love the future. I'm not afraid of the future. I can smell it, and it smells great. William Henry's books, God Making, Blue Apples, The Atomic Christ, City of Peace, One Foot in Atlantis, you're just never going to find anything like this because there is not anything like this. Listen to the information you're getting from William Henry tonight. It's staggering. It's staggering because it's so carefully worked out, so intelligently put together. And this is a mind that said no to all of the illusions by which we live. And yes, let's dare to take a fresh look at the past. Let's say that maybe we lost the thread. William Henry has picked it up. To get his books, call 1-800-898-0284 during business hours or go to whitleysworld.com. You can order them from the special William Henry page over at whitleysworld.com. God Making, Atomic Christ, Blue Apples for $27.50. City of Peace for $17.95. One Foot in Atlantis, $15.25. Worth it. Worth it. Worth it. Okay, William, we talked about the division of the judgment. What does it mean that there will be people who come into the fifth world and people who do not? We talked a little bit about the ones that won't and where they'll go. Who are they and what are they like and how can we identify them among us?
Well, I like to say that there's three types of people. Those who make things happen, those who watch things happen, and then the third group who say, is something happening? And that's, I think, the group you're talking about, right? The people are kind of saying, well, is something happening here?
Well, I was really thinking about a slightly different kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about the people who will be left out of this. Because I can see somebody, a good person, who just is kind of neutral about things, not being left out just
mm-hmm.
because they were neutral. But the ones that are going to be, you know, the energy of what is called the Set energy in some traditions, the energy of Osiris' brother Set,
mm-hmm.
the dark energy, the undoing, unraveling energy, the master of the key, and I have a book coming out myself, by the way, in a few weeks called The Key, with a conversation with a remarkable man that I met in Toronto in 1998, who, among other things, said that evil is intention applied to entropy, the natural tendency of things to disintegrate.
Mm-hmm.
And what about those people? In the book of Daniel, which has got a lot of prophecy in it that's directly relevant to this present era, there's a comment that the wicked will never learn how to do this, how to dance on this wire. And if you're willing to tell us what these people really are like, that's what I'd like to know, the people that aren't going to get into the fifth world.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing
that maybe we can identify them in ourselves.
Yeah, right. The thing that keeps coming to my mind is that story that the lotus, that single flower, the flower of light, flower of wisdom, only blossoms after going through a whole lot of darkness.
Yeah.
And only one in some infathomable number, maybe a million or so, lotuses actually blossom. So the others that don't blossom, their life purpose then is going towards the support of that one flower that does blossom.
Right.
So that may be part of what that Set energy is all about, too, because you need that darkness. You need the manure, if you will, that's going to nourish and fertilize that one flower and the other flowers that choose to blossom.
Yeah, well, another way of putting it is we wouldn't be able to see the stars if it wasn't for the night.
Exactly.
So this division of souls is not going to be a matter of casting certain people who we don't happen to like down into perdition. but rather something else. Do you think you can talk about what else might be?
That's a very good question.
A hard question, I know, but let's see if we can at least dance around a little bit.
Well, I mean, if you look at it in times past, you've always had this plowing under of cultures and of civilizations, and then ultimately you have a renewal of those cultures and civilizations. So from that, you might extrapolate and say, well, these souls will go dormant for a time, and soon, sooner or perhaps later, they'll be given an opportunity to inhabit a vehicle that will enable them to attempt the process of ascension once again. We find that, like, for example, in the Sumerian stories that were so well researched by Zachariah Sitchin, where he described the arrival of a group of space beings that purportedly bioengineered the human race as a slave race. Well, another way to look at that is that in the mystery tradition, a serpent or a soul needs a tree in order to ascend. And that tree is within each and every one of us in our spinal cord system. And by learning how to properly operate this inner tree of life, we're able to reconnect with the heavenly realms.
The serpent in the tree is part of us.
That's right.
Of each of us.
That's right.
Another, and we get now into a deeper meaning of that incredible, and I say incredible because of how compact it is. After all, it's just a few paragraphs long,
right.
The story of Genesis and the story of Adam and Eve in the tree. It's a remarkable story because, of course, it's a story about us and our relationship with ourselves. It is the nature of the journeyers in the spirit to reject the serpent and say, oh, no, that's not me. But it ain't true. We all wear the serpent within us. William, let me ask you this. If there is a way to rebuild the Ark of the Covenant or the Pillar of Osiris. William, are you with me?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, good. Did you hear the question?
Yes.
Okay, could it be done? Could we rebuild the Pillar of Osiris or the Ark of the Covenant?
I most certainly think we could. Yes. And in fact, there have been those that have attempted to make recreations of the Ark of the Covenant. And to my knowledge, I don't know anyone that's rebuilt the Pillar of Osiris, at least, and put it on public display. But I feel that based upon what we know of modern physics, of hyperphysics, hyperdimensional physics, and hyperspace, that, yes, we could most certainly rebuild a Pillar of Osiris. And
would
in fact,
we know what materials to use?
Yes, we would. The pillar is actually made out of palladium, which is an alloy used in making white gold. In fact,
how do we know this?
Well, when it was transported to Rome, they actually called it the Palladium. And you have a whole series of words that coagulate around that PL stem.
We sure do. A lot of important words do.
Yeah, you have, like, for example, the word apple, the word Pallas, as in Pallas Athena, the goddess that once possessed the Palladium. You have the country of the Pali, or Palestine, as a place where this atomic or nuclear tree was once erected for a very specific purpose, the opening of a gateway into another dimension, which I propose was the event that was, if not choreographed, it was certainly experienced by Jesus. Another important word that comes from this tree, this flower of wisdom, is pollen, which brings life. So when you start following the names of this pillar, as I've just done with palladium.
There's also something interesting about pollen.
Mm-hmm.
Pollen may be eternal.
Mm-hmm.
There are pollens that may never decay.
Right. Which is an incredible line of research where they're following up on that ancient idea of panspermia.
Yes.
This notion that bacteria and the seeds of life may be immortal, and in fact that they may be, that this planet may be seeded from space.
Do you suppose the secret of the flowers that are imaged in the Shroud of Turin is that these are flowers from another world?
Well, that's a really powerful speculation. That point seems to ring true to me. Why else would they be so carefully chosen and placed in that event? Absolutely everything that appears on that shroud is there for a reason, to point
absolutely
to something.
Yes. And if so, then those very flowers, they still grow to this day in Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to talking again. We touched a little bit on the Garden of the Gods and the Land of Flowers. And when I thought of a theme for this radio program, I thought it had to be the flower. The program would revolve around the flower. We'd go around the lotus one and another times, plucking the petals and learning as we did so, as we let the wisdom blossom. And in thinking and talking about the flower, and about Jesus, and about the Rosicrucians, how do you think the knowledge... Well, let's back up a minute. Tell us about the Rosicrucians and who they were and where they came from.
Oh, they were a secret society that serviced in France, Germany, and England in the early 1600s.
Right.
They claimed to be immortal beings from a superior race that possessed the Philosopher's Stone, another term for the Holy Grail. They said they could converse with angels and they could make themselves invisible. In other words, they could transform themselves into beings of light. And
they did have extraordinary knowledge about the inner nature of the cross, for example, and of Jesus.
Oh, absolutely. That's their name, Rosicrucian, is derived from the term Rose Cross, the cross of wisdom or cross of light. And as it turns out, the enclosed sun cross, if you take a equal armed cross and draw a circle around it, you have the symbol not only for the planet Earth, but also the symbol for the galactic core. And what you find is the Rosicrucians were great artists too. They left these phenomenal drawings that I use in my book God Making. I also use
yes.
in Blue Apples. And in one of these, we see this, what looks like a brick house that's got some wings on the top of it, and it's got a hand that's reaching down from out of heaven, and it's connecting a string to the top of this house. Well, this house is actually an artistic interpretation of the human body. And what we see in this illustration is a man riding a serpent coming in from the stars. And the date 1604 is written underneath this figure. Well, it turns out this is a reference to a supernova that exploded that came through the lens of the constellation Ophiuchus, which is called the serpent holder or the soul holder, which is the constellation immediately adjacent to the galactic core, which is suggesting that the Rosicrucian secret science that allowed them to transform themselves into beings of light had everything to do with the galactic core. And while that might sound a little bit kind of out there, that the people that studied this are considered the very bedrock of modern science. One of them was Sir Isaac Newton. Another was Thomas Jefferson. Another was George Washington. All subscribe to these ancient beliefs of the Rosicrucians.
That's just amazing. Absolutely amazing. You know, and the relationship between our country and the esoteric world, the hidden world, and the world of secret knowledge is so profound. The leadership of the United States has been in possession, very many of the leaders have been in possession of secret knowledge in the past. I wouldn't say that's been true recently.
No, I don't think so.
No. I mean, I have to tell you, I knew Lyndon Johnson when I was a boy, and he was close to members of my family. I can guarantee you he wasn't in possession of any secret knowledge. Kennedy might have been to a degree, but then you go back a little bit into the past. FDR, yes.
Yes, definitely.
FDR, an essential being in our world, pitted against some of the most profoundly evil grand demons who have ever walked the earth, Hirohito, Hitler, and Stalin.
Mm-hmm.
And playing them like strings on an angelic harp. How did he manage to do that?
Mm. Profound, profound knowledge.
Yes. We're going to be talking in just a couple of minutes. We're just coming up on the top of the hour, and the reason I have come to FDR is we are going to be talking when we get back about one of the very greatest men who ever walked the face of this old earth, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. His head was in the stars, folks. This is Whitley Strieber, it's Dreamland. The ball is about to drop in Times Square. 2001. Come and get me. I'm waiting. Happy New Year.
To purchase cassette copies of this program, dial 1-800-917-4278. Get it in writing with the After Dark Newsletter at 888-727-5505. Premier Radio Networks. And now, here's Whitley.
Happy New Year, New Year! I love it! Say hello to the third millennium, Manhattan. It's gonna be a beautiful. Ever think, what will it be like in a year? That's easy. What will it be like in 10 years? It's a little harder. 100 years. Oh, we'll be finally driving those cars from Back to the Future. What will it be like in 1,000 years in Manhattan? It'll still be there in some form. How about 1,000,000 years? Old Earth will still be rolling around the sun. How about 1,000,000,000 years from now? No evidence at all that the sun's going to blow up between now and then. Will Earth still be rolling around the sun? If so, what kind of a memory will we have left to everything? There is a season, a time for every purpose. We will become part of the past in the fullness of time. I'll tell you where I think we're headed. I think we're headed for eternity. I think that the story of mankind has just started to be written. Just the first few words of the first sentence of a long, long, and wonderful tale. Next week, the TK man, Jeffrey Mishlov, will be talking about a human miracle. Also next week with us is going to be Richard Dolan, one of the best UFO scholars in the world. We had him on the show a few weeks ago. It was a sensation. We're going to be talking about UFOs from the standpoint of somebody who really knows how to do research, who can really make that internet sing, and he learns all kinds of things that you and I cannot find out except from him. It'll be a great show next week. In just a couple, couple of minutes, we're going to return with William Henry. We're having a lot of fun exploring the past and what it may mean for the future. So much is changing, and I will tell you this. The most important changes that are coming down the pike, the re-empowerment of mankind, humanity taking wing, they all have to do with the lost secrets of the past. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Streamland, and we'll be right back. Whitley Strieber, William Henry's fascinating website is williamhenry.net. Don't miss it. To get his books, City of Peace, God Making, The Atomic Christ, Blue Apples, strange titles, strange information, powerful information, as you can hear. Call 1-800-898-0284 during business hours, or go to whitleysworld.com and go to the special William Henry page. You'll find it. If you look down the column on the left, under the Whitley's World store, you will find the William Henry page. Also, One Foot in Atlantis. His books are $27.50 each, except for City of Peace, which is $17.95. One Foot in Atlantis, $15.25. Shipping and handling additional. William, we were talking about FDR, and we've come a long distance on this radio program from the Pillar of Osiris to the Pillar of Peace. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, more than any other man, is responsible for the way the latter half of the 20th century looks, and above all, for the spread of freedom in the world. I know there are those who call him a conspirator and have all kinds of dark ideas about him, but in fact, history, I think, tells the truth. The man set us free. Who was this man?
In his heart, he was a very spiritual man who, as you say, sought to bring freedom to the world. His New Deal is essentially equivalent to the new order of the ages, to the introduction of the new light that would come into our world. And in part, I feel that that's one reason why he agreed, after Henry A. Wallace, the Secretary of Agriculture, and Nicholas Roerich, a Russian mystic painter and guru, who were deeply involved with FDR in many of his occult undertakings, including the search for Jesus in Mongolia, when they said, hey, you know, it's time to pull out the great seal of the United States of America and put it on the back of the $1 bill, he agreed. And in 1935, 1 year after the search for the Christ or Messiah in Mongolia, they stamped that seal on the back of the $1 bill. And to those in the know, in the occult know, that symbolized not only the returning Christ or Messiah, that great light landing on the top of the pyramid as appears on the back of the dollar bill, but it also symbolized a new dawn, a new beginning, effectively what the Book of Revelation calls the New Jerusalem, the new time of peace.
Yes, the foundations of the New Jerusalem have already been laid in our world. The only question now is, how do we build upon those foundations?
Right.
What did FDR find exactly? And here's another question for you. Why did he go? What gave him the idea to go?
The idea came from Nicholas Roerich, who had spent the late 1920s in Mongolia and in Asia, following up on the story that, in fact, tracing the trail believed once to have been walked by Jesus and also by Thomas, who is, according to the Gnostic mystery tradition, Jesus' twin brother. And it was Thomas and Jesus that had both deposited secret teachings in this region. Nicholas Roerich had gone over there. He even claimed to have recovered a sacred extraterrestrial stone that could be used to influence earthly political and cultural affairs, and sought to bring this stone back to the United States to use as a foundation stone for the failed League of Nations.
And, of course, in the end, the United Nations did not fail.
And, of course, right, exactly. And what we find there, just to kind of pick up the story of the way these sacred stones are so important, we have to remember that that missing capstone that appears on the back of the $1 bill is a symbol for something else, much as the black stone.
You mean on the pyramid on the back of the $1 bill?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, the ben of the pyramid, that's the, you're referring to that.
Right.
Yeah.
And that stone of light that is shown descending on that pyramid is the same stone of light that Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld of the UN asked to be installed in the meditation room of the UN. He went over to Sweden, his homeland, and went through over 66.5-ton iron ore blocks before he settled on the one giant black stone that founds that forms the foundation stone of the United Nations building to this day. So this stone of light has been a centerpiece of earthly politics for a very long time. And beginning in the 1930s, with its placement on the seal of the $1 bill or on the back of the $1 bill, and then in the 50s at the UN building, we see men involved in the highest politics on the planet reenacting ancient myths and stories of the recovery of this ancient stone of light.
Could it be that it is recovered?
I think so. I mean, why else would you let those in the know that, hey, the United States, America, is open for business as far as the second coming is concerned, as many believe the symbol on the back of the dollar bill represents. Why would you go to so much trouble to install it in the United Nations? Unless...
Now, let's go back to this. This is one of these interesting William Henry statements that I have to grab. You said the United States is open for business or the second coming. What exactly did that mean?
Well, what it means to me is when you go back and you look at the time when they originally designed the Great Seal, as it appears on the dollar bill, it was commissioned on July 4th, 1776, the Day of Independence, and it was designed under the watchful eye of Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and John Adams.
Yes.
Its purpose was to represent the logo or to symbolize the American enterprise. And in the Masonic tradition upon which they were drawing at that time, that all-seeing eye, that eye or light of God on top of the pyramid, represented the return of the god Osiris. It also represented in the Christian tradition the return of a Christ or Messiah.
Yes.
So when that goes on the back of the single most ubiquitous public document in America, the dollar bill, it suggests to me that the American enterprise is open for business.
What does Anuit Septus mean exactly?
Anuit Septus, out of many, one.
One, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting phrase because there's some argument about it. It's not quite perfect Latin. Novus Ordo Seculorum, of course, a new order of the secular.
Or a New Deal, as they
right.
say.
Exactly, or a New Deal.
Mm-hmm.
And people of the fundamentalist persuasion, some of them hate that secular part of it. They would rather see this as a country that is sealed in the name of Christ rather than sealed as a secular kingdom. And do you think they're right or wrong?
Well, I think that what they're truly afraid of is revelation, knowledge, wisdom, this sort of thing. The fundamentalists have always made an effort to stamp out the true secret and sacred teachings of Jesus. Whereas FDR said, hey, we can create a social order based on them. Let's do it. Let's just go ahead and make an open and free society where all the people, all the religions can come together as one. And that effectively then would create the new kingdom of heaven on earth.
The man I call the master of the key, who I had this conversation with in June of 1998. And since the book's coming out soon, I'm talking about it more because I don't want to frustrate people by talking about it and then not finishing the book, which is a bad habit of mine. In any case, it'll be out in a few weeks. And so one of the things he said was that we live in what he called a culture of blame, and that there is a higher level of world above this, which is a culture of compassion, which he defined as a world in which everyone is given what they need the most, not based on necessarily what they think they need, but based on what those around them, looking truly at them, see that they need. And, of course, that is the vision of FDR. It is the new secular order, because the new secular order is actually founded in the great ethic that came down to us through Christ.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't secular in the sense of dismissing or rejecting that material, but secular in the sense of building on it.
Right. And as I talked about in the Atomic Christ book, as a young man, FDR owned shares in a mining company that was attempting to recover the secrets of the Knights Templar from Oak Island, Nova Scotia.
Yes.
And the researchers that have looked into that treasure feel that it contains documents, and those documents are along three lines. One, the alchemical secrets of transmuting the elements. And the second order are the bloodline or genealogy of Jesus. And then the third order of those documents is that of a new social order, that secular order you're talking about, based upon heavenly principles. And so it was my speculation that perhaps as a young man, FDR had recovered maybe a portion of any one of those three classifications of documents. And in the model of Berenguer Sonnier, who became immensely wealthy, as well as very wise as a result of what he discovered at Rennes Le Chateau, it seemed to make sense to me that above and beyond his upbringing in what amounts to be not really a royal family, but certainly a very wealthy American family,
yes,
that FDR was also a great man of destiny because of any discovery that he might have made at Oak Island.
And I wonder, you know, sometimes you think that people who go on these journeys, as FDR did, and as others have, even if they don't find anything, the mere fact that they go on the journey grants them power and grants them wisdom. But I have to say that FDR was so far beyond that. The way he shepherded this country and through a time of darkness that without a man like him, we wouldn't have made it. Simple as that.
Yeah,
America would have faltered.
I agree. I mean, they called JFK's administration Camelot, or at least Jacqueline Kennedy called it that after his death. But I think really FDR was the true crippled Fisher King, the King of the Grail.
Right. Let's talk about the crippled Fisher King in a little bit and the King of the Grail. Let everybody know exactly who you mean and describe the mythology. Tell the story of the Fisher King.
Well, the story is that you have a king that was wounded by the spear of destiny, ultimately, which is
yes,
the same spear that wounded the side of Christ while he hung upon the cross.
That is allegedly presently in a museum in Austria.
Right, which was one of the treasures that was purportedly sought by Hitler. And the idea is that this king must be reunited with the Grail in order to be healed. And we find a dramatic linkage of this story, of an embodiment of this archetype in the story of FDR when he was stricken by polio and was left with withered legs for the rest of his life. He was literally a crippled king, enacting the model, the archetypal story of the king who is seeking the Grail in order to heal himself, but more importantly, in order to set his kingdom free.
So, in other words, he embodied the myth and the power of the myth flowed through him because of what he was.
That's right, exactly. He regained the use of his hands, and ultimately the paralysis left his back, and by exercising regularly, he was able to develop enormous strength in his arms and that characteristic rock jaw.
Yes.
Everybody so admired in him. It came as a result of his contact with what was the most devilish disease of his time.
Yeah, terrible disease. I think I'm a little older than you, and I grew up at the tail end of the polio era, and it was truly a terror.
Absolutely.
Okay, when we're coming down to the bottom of the hour so quickly. When we get back, we're going to go to the ultimate with William Henry. We're going to talk about the conflict between man and God over the ascension of the human species, which the next 10 or 15 years are going to be all about. So, folks, wait for it. Get your seatbelts tight. We're going to war. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland, and we'll be back.
Set copies of this program, dial 1-800-917-4278. Continues with Whitley Strieber on the Premier Radio Networks.
This is Whitley. We're back, coming in on sailing toward midnight here in Central Time, Mexico, San Antonio, Dallas, Houston, New Orleans, all these wonderful places, Kansas City, up across the dark prairies in the plains, St. Louis, Chicago. Midnight's coming at us 1,000 miles an hour. New York's already knows what it's like in the third millennium. We've been talking to William Henry, seer, master of the secrets of the universe. Amazing man. I know a lot of these things, and I know how hard it is for a person to do the kind of research he's done, to come up with the kind of knowledge that he's found. And not only that, to be able to write it down and to bring it forth. You can open doors to William Henry's knowledge by getting his books. They're all available from whitleysworld.com or from 1-800-898-0284 during business hours. There are four privately published books. The Blue Apples, The Atomic Christ, God Making, each is $27.50. City of Peace, The Holy Grail, The Secrets of Ancient and Modern Nashville. And when we talked about that profoundly weird event that took place close by, and learned why the Oak Ridge National Laboratory may have been placed where it was, the secret knowledge that may have been behind all of that. Well, you can see how interesting City of Peace may be. He's also written One Foot in Atlantis, one of Freeland's deservedly all-time
is a man with his fingers on the secrets, and he wants us to know, and I'm very glad because we need to know. His webpage, and it's great, is williamhenry.net. And in just a minute, we'll be back talking with William Henry as we ring out the old year and bring in the new. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Streamland, and we'll be back. Dreamland, we're back with William Henry. William, in talking about this conflict or state, so I've already satisfied myself that you subscribe to a much more sophisticated concept of good and evil. It was a test earlier that you passed than you normally see in the Disney cartoons. And too many people are just locked into that, and we need to unlock that door. But in any case, the man I talked to in Atlanta, the man I call the Master of the Key, in Toronto, what am I saying? That I call the Master of the Key, primarily offered in plain English, an outline of a kind of technology of the soul, as if he was pointing the way, that the road science needed to go down in order to rediscover the soul and to acquire a technology that enables us to communicate. And he talks about all kinds of different things that we can do. And what's so fascinating is, the instruments he talks about using are all things we have today. It's not hard. It's all around us already. Now, I would like to go from there back 13,500 years to the last time there was conflict between man and God over the ascension of the human species. Tell us what happened then in the memory that you have served so well. What was that about, and what took place?
Well, probably one of the best records of what happened at that time is in the book of Genesis, where God stated that if Adam and Eve ate the fruit of the tree of life and the tree of knowledge, they would die. But then you had this serpent figure come along, and he told Eve that she wouldn't die, but would become as the gods, knowing good and evil. And so when Eve and later Adam ate that fruit, this is exactly what happened. They knew good and evil. So the what appears to have happened there is that either God lied or slightly bent the truth, or God lied and the serpent told the truth.
That's a different way of thinking about it.
And that becomes the whole kind of power pack event in the mythological and scriptural record, where suddenly now you have all these characters coming and going with stories of beings who have quote-unquote awakened and then proceeded to pierce the veil, lift the gate, cross the waters, slay the dragon guarding the treasure house where they find the grail, and attempted to rejoin the two worlds of heaven and earth and inaugurating a new age of where humankind is immortal.
A new age that Franklin Delano Roosevelt sought to set the foundation stone of.
Right.
And interestingly enough, the foundation stone of this age is not on the ground, it's right on top of that pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
That is a foundation stone. You can't even see the palace that is built above it. What does it mean now for our present age? Are we about to face another version of this conflict?
I think so. Usually the forging of the worlds is appears to be happening in our time is done against the will of the old gods and the established world order. And maybe that's in part what World War II was all about, was a transcending of the old gods. When FDR vanquished Hitler, it was a time when, boom, now we're able to move forward now and bring down this new light, because that evil isn't as apparent on the planet. And so what it means for our time is that it's up to each of us now to reach out and bring that life force into our world. And with this is in part what I talk about in my book, God Making, about the ancientness of DNA and what each of us have within our own mystic anatomy as a way to do that. I call that book God Making because, one, with these secrets, with this fire, with this new light or enlightenment that is available to us through our science, technology, and our religion and our knowledge of the ancients, we're able to fulfill that which was denied to Adam and Eve, to become as gods. So we're in the process of making ourselves into gods. But at the same time, we're in the process of making a new god. The old gods, as happened at the beginning of each new age, are left behind. Jesus, for example, came as a shepherd to lead us out of the age of Aries into the age of Pisces, symbolized by the fish.
Yes, and that's why he's called the Fisher of Men.
That's right. That's the origins of the Fisher King. And what will happen in our time, as we leave behind the age of Pisces, we'll see a Fisher King who will then give way to the new Aquarian symbol, which typically is shown as a man or a woman pouring starry-type energy from a vase, which could be a grail. But it's also
called water, and you have a very special definition of water in the lexicon of William Henry, and it's also true that Pisces, the fish, swims in water.
Right.
So in a sense, Pisces is being poured out.
Pisces is being poured out. Hey, yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
And one of the symbols for the age of Aquarius is, of all things, the heron. Well, the heron is the bird of Tula, which the Mayans called the place of herons.
Also a fisher.
And a fisher, exactly. And the Egyptians said at the dawn of each new age, at times such as our own, the heron would emerge from the central sun, Tula, the place of herons, and would land on top of the pyramid of human civilizations, and maybe literally the pyramid at Giza or Heliopolis, the city of the heron. And from its outstretched arms, this heron, which is not just a bird, it's likely a spirit being of some kind, a teacher, from its outstretched arms it would radiate light and then would deliver a teaching designed to transform humans into herons. This didn't mean we would turn ourselves into birds. It meant we would transform ourselves into these higher beings, which the Christians symbolized by the phoenix.
The return of the bird tribes.
The return of the bird tribe, exactly.
We would all become fishers of men.
That's exactly right.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
The energy of Christ, the being of Christ, will finally find its fulfillment in all of our hearts.
Exactly.
So that's where we're coming. That's where we're going.
Yeah, and that's the obvious but strangely seldom acknowledged truth that led the Gnostics to ask everybody to embrace this light and embrace the benevolent beings who began this process in the ancient, ancient world, and their motive was to restore mankind to our rightful status as godlike beings.
To cease to be soul blind and begin to really see, or like the Master of the Key says, God is like... Yeah, like a hologram. God is fully present everywhere, but not in fragmentary form, completely and fully present in each of us, which is an awesome thought.
Mm-hmm.
To think that in fact, all of the knowledge, all of the history, the whole future of the universe is fully present within us. It's why Christ said, the kingdom of God is within you. This time that we live in is about coming to the kingdom.
Right.
Coming to the kingdom.
And so when we fully begin to mirror those attributes of how we define that Christ-like being, it, individually and collectively, that's what is going to prepare us for what the ancients called cosmogenesis, the birth of a new world.
Yes. And the birth of a new world is what this program has been all about. It's why it's taking place on New Year's Eve, why I'm quite certain that millions of people are going to listen to it one way or another, whether on the radio tonight or later, or by recording or buying tapes or whatever. This little talk we've had together, having together, is going to go a long, long way and reach a lot of people in a lot of lives for many years to come. I know that quite certainly. I've known it for a long time, and I've been building up to this for a long time for that reason. Let me ask you this. As we have ranged across the ages looking for the future of man in the past, see if you can reflect for a moment and tell us if there's any most important thing that we've missed talking about yet, or that you'd like to talk about, that you think we should add. And if not, then I'll ask you a question.
Well, one of my favorite things is, and we mentioned it, we touched on it briefly earlier, was this Hopi notion that we're entering this fifth world, and that as we enter it, only love can exist in our hearts. Because if we think a thought of fear, we won't be in that world any longer. And along with that goes this idea that we live in a world of duality, of good and evil, male and female, so on and so forth. And if we continue on that path, and assuming by the Hopi method that, or model, that we enter a world of love, well, it seems that once we're in the world of love, that we'll still have a duality. There will yet be another higher realm to reach up to. And I call that realm love beyond love. And I always encourage people to not only to strive for just bringing love into our world, but to actually going even beyond that and bringing and beginning to imagine, if possible, just as you mentioned earlier, imagine what life will be like a billion years from now. Imagine what love beyond love is like and how we can incorporate that into our world.
When you say love beyond love, define your terms.
Well, if love becomes the base vibration for our world, and we're going to reach up into a higher love, that's what I call love beyond love, for lack of a better word. Hyper-love might be better. It's just the only way I can embrace it or imagine it is just simply a higher love, even beyond love.
The compassion of the master of the key.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I wonder what it will take to draw us to that state. What will it be like here? What, I wonder, will it feel like and be like? I think that probably many, if not most, of the people alive today are going to know what this experience is.
Oh, I really think so, too. I think a lot of people are experiencing it in their daily lives already, but they just don't have terms for it or awareness right. That that's what's happening.
Well, you know, we see it in children, lots and lots of amazing children are being born all around us today. I have a little nephew who's like that, who is just a glorious being. And so are plenty of his friends. It's not uncommon at all. In fact, probably many of our listeners' children are just the same way. They're more than we were,
mm-hmm.
quite frankly. There's no other way to describe it. Because we have built a foundation in which such souls can thrive.
That's right.
This is not a bad place. It's a wonderful place.
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. People get so pessimistic because we have so many environmental troubles. Of course we do. There's lots of us here. Our only sin is we love each other so much. That's why there are too many of us around. That's why we have these problems with the environment. But we'll get past that. That's a sideshow. We'll figure out how to balance everything and make the planet work beautifully for many more of us than we can possibly imagine that are here right now. I have no doubt about that.
Well, I agree. I definitely think that's the path we're headed on.
Now, how much, in terms of exact technology, actual physical technology, do you think may be reemerge or be recreated in the near future?
From the ancient world?
Yeah.
I think if, I mean, you hear these stories that, like, for example, cell phones are ancient technology and this sort of thing. I think we're going to start seeing it coming out all over the place. And a lot of it will probably be based in, for example, near-Earth orbit.
Mm-hmm.
So it won't be as readily apparent on the Earth as it will be once we really begin to fully make that leap into space. It seems like it'll be just a lot easier that way for the mass of the population of the planet to see it come from our own technology in near-Earth orbit, as opposed to understanding that it came out of the ground in ancient Sumeria or in present-day Iraq or wherever. So I think once the space station really gets fully online and we have many thousands of people living in near-Earth orbit, then we'll begin to see it come out, and they'll tell us that it came out of the space program. But really, probably the space program came out of our investigation into the ancient world.
Now, that's fascinating. What a thought. What a great thought. Thank you for that.
My pleasure.
Me. And what a perfect thought on which to end our New Year's Eve program. That music means we have come to the end of Dreamland for the year 2000 and the beginning of Dreamland for the third millennium. I want to say Happy New Year to everybody in Central Time. I want to say God bless to everyone. God bless you, your children. God bless our world and our beautiful country. Watch out, folks. Here comes glory. Our engineer in San Antonio is Don Cooper. Our main engineer has been Will Hilliard. Our producer is Ann Strieber. This is Whitney Strieber with Streamland. We'll be talking at you next week.